Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or to have your events listed, visit friendsof.art. We're also made possible by Alternative Energy Systems, providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers residential, commercial, and agricultural solar energy solutions. More information at 345-6980 or visit savingenergyforlife.com. Up next, we've got Ask Dr. Gale, followed by some great music and more. This is your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KZFR.
You know, it's probably best, other things held equal, for someone in California to have a physician in California and not have them be in Japan or India, because when something goes wrong, it'd be good if there were local resources. On the other hand, you know, when we're looking at me sitting here in Chico and my patients spending a lot of time when they have cancer to drive in and get out of their car and into a wheelchair and into my office, and it's kind of an unnecessary burden, and it would be great to be relieved of some of that for my patients. So yeah, I hope we come up with some new things from this coronavirus. You know, I think as people are thinking about how do I cope with this, because it's obviously been traumatic and devastating and very disrupting, but one of the effective ways of coping with something that's difficult is to occasionally give yourself permission to, you know, look at what the bright side is or some of the benefits. And, you know, we will probably have some benefits out of this. If nothing else, we've all stopped driving. We've all stopped flying airplanes, and the level of air pollution has dropped around the world. And, you know, that's good. Would I have made that trade at the beginning of this? You know, absolutely not. But it's not all bad.
Oh, no. The planet's really happy. And people are also saying that we need to look at this in terms of how we encroach as humans on nature and have these kind of unnatural relationships with these animals that pass the virus on to us. So the climate system, the ecological system, it's all interconnected somehow. You have a certification in psychosomatic medicine. I think of that as mind-body interaction. Psychoneuroimmunology is the term that I would think of. How do you define it? What does that mean?
Well, I think that's a great question. And ever since this subspecialty was instituted, there were arguments about what the name should be. And in other countries, psychosomatic medicine is exactly what you've described. In the United States, what this subspecialty is related to psychiatry and severe medical illness. So there's subspecialties in cancer psychiatry, subspecialties in transplant psychiatry, subspecialties in autoimmune disorders, women's health, things along that line. So very different from the idea of, you know, emotional distress by itself causing people to have physical signs. We might call that a somatoform disorder, which is a DSM diagnosis. But that's not primarily what we're up to in this specialty. And in the last 2 years, the name was changed. It's now called Consult Liaison Psychiatry, because much of what we do is actually consulting for other physicians and providing liaison work between them and the field of psychiatry. So that's the new name for it, which I think is a little more descriptive.
Got it. So do you work with cancer patients because they're depressed and anxious? Is that the main presenting symptom that you're called in to work with? I have cancer, my God, I'm going to die, kind of a feeling.
That is the main presenting question I get. It is certainly not the main presenting diagnosis. The initial studies on anxiety and depression and cancer were done in the 1970s. Post-traumatic stress disorder became an official diagnosis in 1982 or 1983. And even today, when people are doing surveys or studies of distress in cancer patients, they will use those studies, surveys that have been validated for 40 or 50 years, but those do not pick up on post-traumatic stress disorder. So I kept records of the first 100 or so referrals, and the vast majority of those were, please evaluate for depression, and the patient would say they're depressed. And of those 100, there were one or two who had major depressive disorder, which is very different from what the medical literature would say in general. I mean, the general assumption is that they're anxious and depressed, but I find more often they're traumatized and they're afraid.
And when I think of PTSD, I think of a series of traumas that don't get resolved that are one triggers on the other. So if someone is newly diagnosed with cancer, how does that tie into previous unresolved traumas that would lead to PTSD if it's a new trauma?
Well, prior trauma makes people more vulnerable to PTSD, but it's not necessarily the thing that causes it. There's whatever trauma causes it, and you know, most of us could experience something at any given point that's traumatic enough that we would have PTSD symptoms from it. But the process that people go through when they're diagnosed and treated with cancer is traumatic for many people.
Yeah.
And people who have previous trauma are more vulnerable to getting PTSD from that. You know, people who've had authority figures in their childhood or their past who were neglectful or abusive, now they're here with physicians who are doing all sorts of things to them that are painful, and it'd be really easy to, you know, perceive that as, you know, more traumatic than someone else who has really great experiences with authority figures. But cancer is life-threatening. I mean, it's every bit as threatening or more so than going off to military combat. I mean, I don't want to minimize our last 20 years of war, but we've sent a couple million people over there, and I don't know, 15,000 have died. If you had only 15,000 deaths with 2 million cancer diagnoses, you'd be pretty happy. You know, it is a life-threatening event for many people, and that's traumatic. And then there's all these treatments that are, you know, painful and cause side effects, and it can be a very difficult process. And people have the standard symptom clusters of post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, they've got a life-threatening event, they get nightmares, they have flashbacks, they have avoidance, they, you know, feel jumpy, elevated startle response, they're irritable, feel numb. You know, that's what PTSD looks like. And most people would just say, oh, they're depressed, because in our country, we overgeneralize the use of that word. We use depression to describe every sort of bad feeling there is, just about. So,
what do you find in terms of people who are resilient or hardy, have hardiness in dealing with a traumatic diagnosis? Do you find like a personality trait, or who do you find is the most resilient when faced with cancer?
That is a great question. I do not get to study the people who don't have problems with it because they don't get referred to me. But I can extrapolate from other experiences that people who have experienced hardships in the past but have had support and people around them to help them negotiate the hardships are the people who tend to do the best. Mm. You know, being emotionally healthy does not automatically emanate from having had no trials or tribulations in life. You know, some of those people can be very brittle. The first time something goes wrong, they don't know how to handle it because it's never happened before.
There's a name for them, the fragile teacups of the first-year college students who've had helicopter parents who don't let them fall down and scrape their knees and climb trees and whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So when you're dealing with someone who's severely depressed, psychiatry has really moved from the original model of Freud and Jung, where you talked and you talked about your dreams to understand your unconscious influences and your projections on your therapist and all this interesting unconscious dance between the analyst and the patient. And then I guess because of insurance company pressure and so little time, the psychiatry model moved to let's have a drug, an antidepressant, an anti-anxiety. And I'm wondering how you feel about that.
I think it's a pendulum that swings back and forth, but there are definitely financial pressures. You know, a psychiatrist who tries to be a psychotherapist in private practice is going to have a very difficult time because they have an overhead and the reimbursement for their services for psychotherapy is not going to cover the overhead. So if you want to do something like that, you either have to practice somewhere where you can charge cash prices and a wealthy area where people can afford to pay that, or you have to find some little niche, which is what I've done, because on my inpatient unit, we're often not that busy, and there's revenue from the patients being in the hospital, and Lo wanted me to be here, so they let me practice the way I want. And so for me, that's a lot of psychotherapy. But the pendulum really has swung that direction. There are people who want their psychologist to be able to prescribe meds, and I just think, oh my gosh, be careful what you want, ask for, because if they start feeling that same pressure, you know, that I'm reimbursed the same amount of money for a 10-minute med check as I am for an hour of psychotherapy, then all our psychologists and therapists are going to be feeling that same pressure to say, I'm just going to prescribe meds. And meds are not the answer to every problem.
Right. Some people say, well, cognitive behavioral therapy is helping people understand how to change their thinking about an issue works. What do you tend to have a kind of a toolbox that you use with patients in addition to medication prescriptions?
Yeah, absolutely. I do a lot of psychotherapy for trauma. That's part of my cancer practice. But I also find a fair number of people who come into the inpatient psychiatry unit are also traumatized. And, you know, that might be why their antidepressants haven't worked all these years, is because there's really something else going on. It's not major depressive disorder or not major depressive disorder by itself. Sometimes when I'm feeling really snide, I ask people, how big of a cast do you put on your arm when your leg's broken before your leg feels better? And that's what can happen with, you know, when it's completely directed toward medication management, is you just keep piling on pills hoping something will help, but that might not be the answer.
So it sounds like when you're doing psychotherapy, we want to understand that the underlying feeling that you have is because of this experience when your parents were divorced when you were 8 or whatever it is. So it's a cognitive kind of, oh, okay, now I understand why I've been carrying around this for so long.
That can be part of it. The psychotherapies for post-traumatic stress disorder are pretty varied and complicated, so it's not easy to summarize in one or two sentences. However, what I tend to use is neurobiologically informed narrative therapy. I help people to understand what happened in their brain when they were traumatized, why they have the reactions they have, and then develop a different narrative so that they can learn to control those reactions and not be re-traumatized. There's many other ways to handle this. Historically it was exposure therapy, and that's based on the idea that no matter what the experience is, if someone is exposed to that and, you know, runs through it enough times, that their brain is going to get bored. And it's not going to be so traumatic, but that works very well in very experienced hands. But if it's doesn't go well, it can actually, you know, make the person worse, because sitting in a room having to talk to somebody about something that happened in the past that you don't want to talk to while they you pay them to do that is an awful lot like being kidnapped. So it can be traumatizing in and of itself.
What about EMDR using eye movement desensitization, Francine Shapiro's technique, or energy psychology like acupressure tapping?
I think that's kind of mixed. Personally, I think that the narrative of what the therapist is talking about and what they're leading the patient through with that is very important. And that might end up being the thing that matters most. I've seen patients who really benefited from those types of therapy, and I've seen patients who have gotten a lot worse. Mm. And my thought is that it probably has to do with what the therapist's narrative was and kind of what images they were putting into the patient's mind.
In terms of trauma, I'm sure you know Levine's work, where he has his patients kind of act out overpowering the trauma, you know, I guess it's a kind of a desensitization thing. What do you think about Levine's approach?
I don't know of that personally, but that is the type of thing that we would call, or I would call in general, an exposure therapy. There are some folks at Columbia and Cornell who showed me what they were doing for combat trauma. They got a video game manufacturer to recreate every city in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan, and every military base and every piece of military equipment. And they have the patient write out their trauma, what happened. They recreate it on a video game, and they have the person watch that over and over and over while they narrate it. And again, if a person can do that with a therapist that can keep them from being over-activated by it, then that can be very helpful. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine if that doesn't work, it could go bad. It's, you know, kind of like desensitizing someone from their fear of bridges by getting them out on a bridge. You just better make sure that bridge doesn't collapse or there's not a riot or an explosion, because it's going to, you know, prove to their brain that this is a problem. So
I think the theory of the energy psychologies is that you replace the memory. So that which seems overwhelming and produces PTSD gets replaced by something where you have control of the incident. I guess it's what you said. It depends on the therapist and the patient and their dynamic and how they work together and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Did you go through analysis as part of your med school training?
No, I didn't.
So how do you know what your projections are, what's being triggered in you personally?
So that was part of our training in psychodynamic therapy, but we learned to do that by being trained in it and, evaluating lots of video recordings of interactions with patients that are, you know, reviewed with our professors. But that being said, you know, you were talking about how things had shifted toward medication management. In my kind of era of being trained, there were many psychiatrists I've spoken with who their psychotherapy training was very brief, maybe four patients, and they thought they had good training. And, you know, where I trained, that was much more of a focus. And so I had a good couple years that's primarily what I was working on. So it can vary a lot from, you know, one psychiatrist to another.
So when you were in training in Texas, your professor could say, now, I notice there's kind of a bias here in your approach to this woman or this man, or so they would point out your biases, I would assume, as part of their feedback, if you had them.
They may not be that direct, but they would certainly ask questions about, you know, what I was thinking or what I was thinking the patient was thinking. My psychiatry training was actually at UC San Francisco at the Fresno campus. So that's where I did my my psychiatry residency.
Mm-hmm. In terms of this, people being kind of locked up at home, I'm wondering if we have suggestions for them. So like someone who has PTSD and feels agoraphobic and can't go out, lives in an apartment, how would you guide them as to how to cope?
Well, there's definitely no one size fits all, but I think, you know, this is a time for people to try to be aware of what is helpful for them and what's not. It is okay to be sad and mourn losses at this time. They are real, and that's a healthy thing. At the same time, healthy mourning does not focus on the loss exclusively. It kind of oscillates back and forth. And so to intentionally spend some time thinking about, you know, what are the benefits of this, or are there any good things that have come out of it, and focus on those. And, you know, not everything we lost is bad. You know, some people are at home and they've been freed from a job they didn't like, or, you know, maybe have more time with their children. And that might be good or it might be bad. But for the people that's good, you know, to take some pleasure in that.
Right.
I also think that studies have been very clear in the results that when there's a catastrophe, people who are exposed to news media, both conventional broadcast and online, that the more they're exposed to it, the more likely they are to get post-traumatic stress disorder. So I think really setting some time limits on, you know, how much time we spend reading about this disaster, and trying to figure out how to detoxify or some type of ritual to, you know, clear our minds of that is a good thing. For me, it's like a half an hour three times a week, and that's my limit. I don't need any more of that.
To watch the news?
Exactly, yeah. Or even just read about it online. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get plenty from my medical reading. I mean, I'm in communication with other psychiatrists around the country, and we're talking about how we're treating patients who've had the coronavirus, and I probably get enough of that I don't really need any more of, you know, hearing what the nightly news says, or you know, delving into any of the horror stories on the internet. So I really try to keep that limited, and I think it's probably good advice for most people.
Yeah, I'm kind of addicted to Rachel Maddow, and it's so sad to hear the stories about the prisons where everybody's infected, and the nursing homes where these elderly people are dying and it's very overwhelming. Yeah. You mentioned having some kind of renewing ritual or quiet time. Would that be meditation, dancing, singing? I don't know. What would be an example of that kind of a restorative ritual?
those are great examples. Going for a short walk, you know, playing music, meditation, yoga, exercise, anything along those lines could be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that exercise changes the endorphins in the brain? Is there really a brain chemistry change that happens?
That's my understanding. I think that's correct. You know, people have talked about a runner's high, and I think there's also literature that suggests for many people who are depressed that 5 minutes of vigorous exercise can do a lot to help relieve that. I think it stimulates something that can get the brain going.
Mm-hmm. You also do a lot of work, I read, with people with ADD, ADHD. And when you're treating adults, what do you find is eye-opening for them? Because probably a lot of them don't think of themselves as having ADD. Is that right?
I think that's correct. You know, there's this question about depression in adults and, you know, do antidepressants work? And, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is one of those diagnoses that I come across quite frequently where the person comes to me saying they're depressed, but they're actually discouraged. You know, someone who is higher than average intelligence, who doesn't do well in their career, who makes mistakes that other people think are careless, but they're trying as hard as they can, and they keep getting this message from people that they've got some sort of moral problem or they don't care, that can be really discouraging. And that looks an awful lot like depression, but it's probably not going to be fixed with an antidepressant. It'll be fixed if people can perform better. And, you know, there's coaching that can be done for ADHD, and there's also medications. And I think some combination of those can help optimize people's performance. And also knowing about the diagnosis can, again, give them a alternative narrative that it's not because they're stupid or they don't care or they're morally flawed, but they have problems with, you know, their attention and being able to control that, and they get distracted. So that's usually the way I approach it.
There's a physician who has ADD who wrote a book about it, about coping, and I think his main strategy was if you have ADD, you have to structure things. You have to have a calendar, and you have to write down your lists, and you have to have a create a structure so that you don't feel overwhelmed all the time by this input that's coming into your brain. I think it's called Driven to Distraction was the book. Hollowell, yeah. Something like that.
Yes. Yeah, I'm familiar with his work. He has some very good points, and I think those are great books. The only caveat I'd have is books about ADHD written by people with ADHD tend to have the types of disorganization that someone with ADHD would have. And his at times can be hard to follow and have, you know, I forget there's one place where he's like 137, whatever. And, you know, that is not the sort of thing that I want my ADHD patients to be trying to read through 137 of anything. But he's done good work, and it's, you know, I'm really glad he wrote those books, and I think it's been really helpful to make the general population more aware of this condition.
Kids are traditionally given Ritalin. Do adults get the same kind of medication if they're medicated, or is it a different system with a mature adult?
With mature adults, that also tends to work. Ritalin or Adderall are the main two stimulants we use. There are some other medications that don't tend to work quite as well, but they work by different mechanisms, and so sometimes the combination helps. And I really find the combination of medication and, you know, coaching for what I call tricks of the trade, the things that you mentioned that Hollowell talks about, you know, ways of being organized, ways of writing lists. It can take me a long time to get a patient to do that. I mean, three or four sessions before they'll buy the notebook, and then they come the next one and they've lost it. And that's attention deficit disorder. I mean, that's the way that works. And those are the things that get them fired from jobs and, you know, showing up to a meeting without the essential materials or the things you said you'd bring. But once we can help them to get some patterns in place where they work on these things, they, you know, can do much better in life and be much more satisfied.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a truism that half the battle is understanding the battle that you're fighting. And so if I know I have ADHD, then I can, oh, okay, now I understand why I feel overwhelmed all the time and forget and get distracted. And then I can start to resolve some coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or even not be so hard on yourself when it happens. You know, one of the things that I'll talk to people about who have ADHD is that people with this condition tend to have trouble with modulating their attention and with initiating and completing tedious tasks. That's by definition, but they also tend to be more creative. And, you know, if you had the choice of your creativity or being better organized, you know, which would you rather have, assuming that you can't have it all? And for many people, that helps them to have, you know, a sense of a little more peace with this, of being able to say, you know what, I'm not very organized, but I am creative. And this doesn't mean I'm stupid. It just means I have trouble with organization, and it helps them to just kind of move on with a little bit more peace and equanimity when, you know, these problems come up.
Why is it that boys are more likely to have it, or is that not true? But it certainly seems like there's a, it's just like a stereotype. Oh, well, he's a boy. He has ADD.
Yeah. I think that is a stereotype and a social bias. Women, girls will more often use that extra energy and restlessness, you know, when they're in elementary school to talk. and because they have a higher social drive, but also their higher social drive might help them to contain some of their symptoms at a time when a, you know, a 7 or 8 year old boy won't. And so boys are more likely to get diagnosed. They're more likely to be disruptive, which it bothers the teacher, whereas, you know, silently daydreaming doesn't bother the teacher. Also, you know,
I think girls draw a lot. They keep their fingers going drawing.
Yeah, so doodling, you know, is probably not going to bother the teacher. Getting up and running around will. But also in our country, you know, there's been this gender bias that a boy not doing well in school is something that needs intervention because, you know, he needs to be educated. Whereas a girl who's not doing well in school, it's like, well, you know, she's just going to go get married anyway, right? So I think it's probably pretty equal, but there's been more of a focus on boys.
And do you find that with your adult patients as well, that's fairly equal gender-wise?
Absolutely, yes.
And does it present differently in adult women?
That I really don't know. I'd have to stop and think about it. It's, you know, there's definitely differences in the way men and women respond to similar stresses. But again, you know, women tend to have a higher social drive and be more socially attuned. And so there are, yeah, I'd say there probably are differences in, you know, sensitivity, to and responses to rejection and criticism. One of the things that I see, you know, in kids or kind of a dividing line is when people are getting this criticism that doesn't make sense to them when they're young, they can take a narcissistic stance to it, which is the idea that, you know, authority figures don't, they say a lot of things to me that don't make sense. Like they tell me I'm not paying attention and I don't care, but I am trying to pay attention and I do care. And so the authority figure is not credible. Or they could take a self-blame position and say, you know, everybody tells me I don't care and they tell me I'm bad, so I must be. You know, I had a patient who once was a quad amputee from his untreated diabetes, and I said, why did it get this far? And he said, because I don't care. And I said, do you care that you don't care? And he's like, of course I care that I don't care. I'm not going to get to see my kids graduate from high school, and this is going to kill me. And I said, you know, where did you get the idea that you don't care? And he said, well, when I was 9 years old and I wasn't taking care of my diabetes, they said I don't care. And he just accepted that.
Programmed.
As soon as I told him that the fact that he cares about not caring suggests that he cares, I mean, he got that. And this person, you know, I think this is an example of where treating an adult can make a big difference. He was the one of the most problematic patients for the renal dialysis center. He wouldn't make it to the appointments on time. Then he would be frustrated. He was always, you know, blaming something. And I put him on Ritalin. He was able to control his impulses. He was able to organize. He was able to get to his appointments on time. He became one of the most delightful people. And the dialysis center offered me a job. They were like, we can do this with like three or four of our hardest patients. We're willing to pay your salary. I had other things to do, but it made a huge difference in this person's life to be have this recognized and treated.
Oh, that's so powerful. I'm really interested in the autism spectrum because I'm working on a book about girl climate activists, and Greta Thunberg and her circle of friends say that being they don't use Asperger's anymore, but being on the spectrum gives them ability to focus, to be original, to not be overwhelmed by what other people say. So that they're looking at it kind of as you suggested. What can I learn from my ADD or whatever, the creativity? They think of autism as giving them focus. And I wondered why there's so many more kids that are supposedly on the spectrum. Is it just because we're diagnosing and we didn't before? Or what's going on, and why so many kids autistic?
That's a great question, and whoever answers that gets the Nobel Prize. So okay. I don't know. A couple things I can say about that is that, you know, autism occasionally does provide people with exceptional abilities, and those should be celebrated. I don't know if there's something in our environment that's causing there to be more autism. But I can say I do run across adults with autism who have, you know, struggled through their whole life with this and it just wasn't recognized. So my guess is that part of this is that we've become more sensitive to it. And I think there's still a lack of sensitivity to autism for women. Again, because of female social drive, a girl with autism or mild autism, she may function socially about as well as an average boy. That's not good enough to maintain relationships with girls who are her peers, so she may be rejected a lot. But you take that girl and you put her in with a male psychologist who's rating her, and he might not notice any problem because her social reciprocity is pretty good for a boy. And so I think we're just not as sensitive with girls to pick up on some of the symptoms when it's more mild.
I interviewed a psych prof at Chico State whose daughter didn't get diagnosed until she was in her late 20s. And they said, oh, she's borderline. She's bipolar. And she wasn't. But it took until she found a therapist in Yuba City who could say, okay, you're on the autism spectrum, and this is what you need to plan for feeling overwhelmed and plan in this way, so then she could make it through school. But she's an example of that. And yes. Her mother said she learned how to express behaviors. She could copy it. She didn't maybe feel it, but she could learn to mimic it. So it wasn't... it wasn't the same as, so she didn't get diagnosed.
Yeah. And that often happens if someone is very well socialized, they won't be diagnosed. And many people who have autism spectrum end up in things like the performing arts, where they can mimic other people, they can memorize lines, they're very comfortable because on the stage they have these conversations where they know how it works out and it's predictable. And then, you know, in their regular life, people aren't predictable. So they end up, you know, in that area of, and they're people that, you know, most people would just not think that they have, you know, any psychiatric disorder, much less autism, because some of them are stand-up comedians and, you know, very well-known actors and actresses.
It's such a strange phenomenon, because at one end, there's people who are really autistic who can't communicate verbally, and the other end, there's people who are genius, or what do they call the savants who can memorize, you know, oodles of numbers and stuff. So it's a strange, it's so, there's such extremes in that mental process, whatever you call it.
Yeah, I think the term spectrum is very appropriate that way. And there's a large range of function. There are people like Bill Gates, who I had long thought maybe had autism spectrum, and I've heard, I don't know for sure, but I've heard that he's actually announced that he did, that he does. And, you know, that's one of the people that I point out to my patients when I'm diagnosing that, you know, he did okay in life.
Yeah, I'll say.
This is not necessarily a recipe for disaster. He was lucky that he was interested in computers at the right time, and fortunate to have a dad who's a billionaire, and, you know, to be able to be accommodated. But for someone who has autism and has, you know, very special circumscribed interests, if they can find a way to use those to do something that somebody else cares about, they can do really well.
Like Greta.
Yeah.
She's so powerful.
I had a patient in New York who I eventually realized who had autism. He had a journalism major. He worked for a plumbing supply company, or actually a plumbing company. And the thing was, you could tell him an address in Manhattan and he could tell you when that building was built and therefore what kind of plumbing it had.
Wow.
So I don't know exactly how this works, but I imagine that most plumbers, you know, go out, dig into a problem, figure out what's wrong, order the parts. In a few days, or maybe a next day, they arrive. But this guy's company, they always had the parts on the truck. And, you know, he did that for 30 years or something like that. And, you know, they loved him, of course. Who wouldn't love that? But, yeah, give him an address. He can tell you, you know, this building was built in such and such a time, and that was right when the time they switched from, you know, lead to brass or whatever, and he would know the sizes of pipes and the fittings, and so he'd just make sure those are all on the truck. So
I wanted to ask you about a couple other definitions, because they're in the political arena, and that mm-hmm. is psychopath or sociopath and narcissist. So how do we define those? And what is there a difference between a sociopath and a psychopath?
In general, that would be the same thing. You know, it's two terms in my mind used to describe the same type of behavior and mental framework. So a sociopath, the actual term is antisocial personality disorder. So let's stick with that. I won't define something that's used broadly. And a psychopath, I'm not sure what that is, but let's talk about antisocial personality disorder. Is a person who does not plan ahead, who tends to lack compassion for other people, and does not feel any need to fulfill commitments. I think of that as being a little bit like a reptile. I mean, a snake doesn't mind eating its own young if it happens to fit its needs. And, people think that they know what a person with antisocial personality disorder looks like, but there was this great article in the Wall Street Journal about 30 years ago after somebody took down a whole bunch of organizations with their investment scheme, you know, about why do intelligent people get sucked into this? And part of it is because they can be very charming when it suits their needs. You know, they don't necessarily look like the people on TV that, you know, get portrayed as someone with antisocial personality disorder. And they also do and say things that a normal person never would, because we would know that we would get caught. But they're not thinking that far ahead. So, you know,
what I've heard is they don't have a conscience. They don't feel guilt.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And how does that fit in with narcissism? Are they kind of intertwined?
They're in the same cluster of personality disorders, but a narcissist is someone who, and this is not the full definition, but the gist of it is someone who thinks that they constantly deserve special treatment and things should go very well for them and people should defer to them, kind of fits in with the narcissistic model.
But a narcissist could have a conscience?
Yes. In fact, you know, could, you know, really, if they're rebuked by someone or by the universe, you know, could have a very catastrophic response. You know, people who are highly narcissistically organized, if they fail, sometimes they'll kill themselves. Whereas someone with antisocial personality disorder would only kill themselves if they thought it would benefit themselves. You know,
they fake their death for the insurance policy.
They're just looking for the next person to exploit. So where a narcissist, you know, having their business crumble or being told that, you know, you can't do this anymore, when that's something that's kind of ingrained in their habits, you know, could be very devastating to them.
A group of psychiatrists wrote a book about our president warning that he was those things. Do you think it's possible to make a diagnosis with someone that you haven't had in your office?
I think it's really risky. And, you know, we have this Goldwater, I forgot what we call it, rule. Because that's, you know, some psychiatrists or therapists said that about Barry Goldwater, and, you know, that he wasn't fit to be president psychiatrically. And you know, when all was said and done, what was decided is that's probably political bias. And so I think it's really dangerous for people to be making a diagnosis of someone they've never met, particularly a politician. Yeah, I don't think it's appropriate.
Okay. This is a completely different topic. I'm winding up here. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the physician, found out that some of her patients had near-death experiences. And I'm interested in this because I just finished a book, a trilogy about where I interviewed 65 visionary scientists and physicians. And some of them are really interested in NDEs, like even Alexander, the surgeon, had his own mystical near-death experience. And I wondered if you have had patients who have had them and told you about them.
No, I don't believe I have. I've maybe had one or two, but it wasn't the, you know, it wasn't the focus of what we were working on. I do think that, you know, a lot happens in the brain when people are nearing death or in a coma. And so even though I have my own spiritual values, I tend to, as a physician, not put too much weight on what people, you know, say they experience when they're in that state of consciousness. I have had, and maybe I have had lots of patients with near-death experiences, but I just interpret it differently. Often they're delirious. I get called for, you know, evaluating them for trauma. I've had people think that they were in a prison torture camp in Africa and, you know, thinking that strange things are happening at night, but also, you know, have other things happen that are less traumatic. But most of those I don't get called to consult on because they're not troubled by it.
Right. The people who have the NDEs are very clear they're not hallucinations. So the patients themselves say, no, it wasn't a hallucination. It was a very distinct experience of whatever. I want to ask you one more thing, and that is, why is it that anxiety and depression meds often don't work? They'll be like not much more than placebo, or placebo does better or something. Why is it so unpredictable what's going to work, and we try this and this till we get to that?
I think that's a great question. I have a couple thoughts on that. One, the initial studies on the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil, those types of medicines, those were really encouraging. And so much so that there were, you know, medical schools that changed their psychiatry department from the Department of Psychiatry to the Department of, you know, neurobiology or something like that, behavioral neurobiology. But the manual that we use, not to make a diagnosis, but to know that we're on the same page when we're talking about an illness, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And that defines depression, major depressive disorder, very narrowly. And when those medicines came out and they were considered relatively safe, then they started to be widely prescribed. You know, now someone can come into their doctor and say, I'm depressed. And the doctor says, oh, you must be depressed. And here, have some of this pill. But maybe it's not major depressive disorder. And one of the areas, you know, of why I'm interested in this, you know, medical illness and psychiatry is I get lots of patients who have other things going on. You know, I've had patients with sinus infections and leukemia and, you know, autoimmune disorders, and many of them where it was too many medications. And, you know, their perception was they were depressed. Antidepressants aren't going to work for those. I think if we were more judicious in the application of antidepressants, we'd find they were much more helpful. But even so, I would suggest, you know, the criticism that they only work on half the people. If we had a pill that could come out for $50 to $80 a month, that would cure half the cancer patients, we'd be pretty ecstatic.
Yeah.
And so, 50% is not bad. It just means, what do we do about the other 50%? And, you know, do they really have that condition, or is there some other cause for depression that needs to be, you know, figured out? There's also very good data that, you know, there's a certain response to antidepressants, there's a certain amount of response to psychotherapy, and that those tend to work synergistically. When you combine the two, you tend to get even better. So that's my thought on that. And then finally, one other just about what is depression. There are some studies out of Denmark that suggest that antidepressants really, maybe what they more do is increase neuroplasticity so people can appreciate the life they have.
Wow.
And what there's research indicates if you give an antidepressant to someone who's got a bad life, their depression gets worse. Maybe they can appreciate that more. And that really fits in with what we called major depressive disorder back in the 70s. The prototype is someone who's got a good life, you know, married with kids and a job they enjoy, and then suddenly it all goes flat and they can't enjoy this good life. That's very different than, you know, someone who's been severely traumatized or, you know, has lost everything in their life that they care about. That might not be major depressive disorder, so maybe an antidepressant isn't the right treatment.
And what's the difference chemically if there's a brain chemistry for anxiety rather than depression?
One of my professors said, no matter how complicated you think the human brain is, it ain't that simple. So I don't have an answer for that. I really don't. I think, you know, what causes major depressive disorder is very complicated. It's obviously not a simple, you know, shortage of serotonin or norepinephrine. If it was, these medicines would work much quicker. It is something else going on in the brain. And I don't know what that is, but these medicines do work, you know, for some people, and for them, that's great.
Hmm. Is there anything else that you'd like people to have as a coping mechanism during the pandemic when people are anxious and scared, if they are, that we haven't talked about?
I think probably the most important takeaway message is, you know, this is a time for exquisite self-care, to limit how much time we spend focusing on what's bad in the world out there that we can't control. It's okay to mourn our losses and really be sad, and for people with children to realize this does not have to be a life-ruining trauma. This could be a time where they learn how to cope with things that are not going the way they want. And a lot of the way they're going to decide on how bad this is really depends on how their parents and people around them respond to it. As an example of that, I had a friend growing up, or actually as an adult, who told me they had all these marvelous camping trips when she was young. As an adult, she realizes they were homeless. But that wasn't, you know, their perception. It was just, we're going camping for the summer, and they had a great time. And so, people can be protected, and they can learn to cope, and they can learn to manage, you know, and the absence of difficulty does not necessarily make one emotionally healthy. What makes one emotionally healthy is learning to cope with difficulty in a mature way. So we all have an opportunity to work on that.
That's those magic words of resiliency and hardiness. So we can look at it as a chance to exercise those muscles.
Yeah.
Great.
One final thought I have is that, you know, for people who are having difficulty coping, I think reaching out for help before things completely fall apart is important. And we are here in Low Behavioral Health 24 hours a day.
You're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM and KZFR.com.